You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCRLP, 92.9 FM, Los Gatos and beyond.
Hi, my name is Sasha Vasiliuk, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony. Get on the Drinks with Tony show.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Sasha Vasiliuk. She's the author of Your Presence is Mandatory. Sasha, how are you?
I'm great. Nice to see you, Tony.
Nice to see you too. In the glow of a debut novelist, how does it feel getting your first novel out there?
Oh my goodness. You know, this used to be a document on my laptop, on my dusty, kind of worn out laptop. And now it's this thing that I can hold.
That might have been my internet.
Hold, and then other people in multiple countries. I don't know. Like, I don't think I've wrapped my head around it really.
It is weird to go from idea to working on it for years and sweating it out to actually seeing it kind of as a product almost.
Yeah. I mean, this is a product. I did my unboxing. This is now a thing that authors do. They unbox and videotape themselves somewhat awkwardly. And there's so many of them in there, and it's a very red cover. And so It's just like a very heavy box full of very red things. Yeah, but yes, it's an idea that turned into a product. That's a good way of putting it. And there's some strangeness that comes with that, right?
Yeah. Because it's heavy. I mean, it's heavy to write for that long. Just writing a novel is just one of the, like, I mean, I'm on rewrites right now on one. And sometimes I'm just like, this is the dumbest decision I've ever made in my life to write. And why do I do this? But at the same time, my soul is the novel. I adore the novel. I'm insatiable about finding great writers and reading everything I can. So of course I'm going to do this marathon of woe and some joy.
Yes. Yes. I know. I think it will be, you know, there's so many things that you don't think about when you're writing your first. Mm-hmm. And that now I will be aware of in the future forever, you know, all the publishing stuff that I just wasn't concerned about at all. And I feel like I'm going to miss that innocence to a certain degree in the future as I begin on. Yeah.
I don't know. All I know is that I like screwed up royally on like about five different things when my first novel came out. And I just can't wait for like my next one to come out because I feel like I've learned, but the landscape might be so different that I'll be like, I've learned. And then all of a sudden they'll be like, sit down, Tony. You know nothing. Get out of
our
way.
You know nothing.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully I won't feel like I screwed up royally on five things. But now that you put that into my head,
no, you won't
sleep over all the things.
No, you won't. I, for some odd reason, I had an arrogant chip on my shoulder a little bit, and that that set me up to do some really stupid things. And then also, I didn't know what I was doing. Nobody, there's no guidebook for, hey, when your first novel comes out, you know, I didn't know when to check with my agent regarding the cover art. I didn't even know that she would care. And then I gave the go ahead to the company, because the company was just like, this is great. All the booksellers are going nuts. We need you to approve this now. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, it's approved. It's fine. And then my agent was just like, what the hell were you thinking? This is, and I was just like, I was supposed to get in touch with you. It's, you know, I'm just trying to be cool with everyone. You know, it's just like, no, you guys do your thing. You're good at what you do. But I had to be more, it's important to be communicative, I guess. And I didn't realize that. So,
yes. Yeah. You're thrown sort of into this world with like all kinds of parties involved, and you don't really nobody fully explains to you like whose goals are what in a way.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and who would care about a thing versus not care about a thing.
Yeah.
And like what their individual priorities are between your like publicist and your marketing person and your editor and whoever else works over there and your agent. Yeah. It's like a lot of, you're thrown into a company about which you know, not, you know, like the employees of which you know nothing about, kind of.
Right. And you don't even know how the company works, and they're having daily meetings about stuff, and you're in those, you're on those meeting agendas, but no one loops you into what's going on.
No.
It's There was some one author I just read. He was a young adult author. You know, he sold like 5 billion books or whatever those guys do. And he's just like, I couldn't have done this without my assistants. Assistants plural. And I'm like, what I could do with an assistant? Oh my God, someone who knew, like, he's just, I just picture him getting a manicure and a pedicure and like just dictating and just going, you know, it was a cold and stormy night. Put that in, darling, you know.
This actually reminds me of my grandma. So she wrote a memoir, except she didn't really write. I think she may have been writing the first part herself, but then she took a hiatus for like 10 years and then had a stroke or two and then decided to finish the memoirs, at which point she couldn't like even see or walk really, right? So she was dictating them, and it was these two younger women, I don't know if they were students, I don't know who they were, but they would come and they would, you know, take down her dictations, and somehow they transferred into the book. Anyway, so I now have this memoir, which was actually very useful to have. It really helped me write my novel. But there's definitely inconsistencies, or there's like things that repeat that I was like, I swear I already read this part. And then two chapters later, it appears either the same or kind of like slightly different.
Yeah.
Because clearly that's but yes, but this like dictating your memoirs to somebody is such a, you know.
It almost, you know, as we talk about it, I'm just like, you know what? I need to, when I'm, you know, when I have a little more money, I might just do that. Maybe it'll be a documentary. I'll just film myself dictating my memoir to somebody and
call it The Dictator.
Yeah. Dick would be very large. The Dictator. So that's so cool that your grandma wrote. I wish I had writers in my family, because it didn't get published, right? Her memoir.
No, I mean we published like 10 copies of it, you know, in this.
Yeah, but still, how wonderful, because it's almost like it's just so fascinating. You know, I wish my grandparents had journals or wrote anything, but you know, their list of how many vodkas they need to buy at the you know. They didn't even do that. They just knew 6 vodkas. So anyway.
Yeah, no, I think about like right now, right? People today are very much like recording a lot of things, too many things.
Yes.
And then, but two generations ago, like no one was really, one was writing things. And in Soviet Union, especially, I will tell you, because it was either a dangerous or shameful or all the things that I sort of, that gave me reason to write my novel. And it was this, and I feel like there's a huge gap in history because of it. Like Soviet history, I think like many kind of histories of big empires, US being one of them, are written not just like by victors, which is right, like the common saying, histories written by the winner, but also by kind of like whoever is the governing body at the time. And there's all these private stories that don't really make it either out at all from like the person who experienced it, or they don't really go beyond the family, right? But those are often the truer history, right? Because those people were there. They don't have an agenda necessarily, right? They're not trying to like convince the general public and give them like textbooks to educate children in a certain way and tell them certain things and skip over certain things, right? As history books and empires tend to do. And I feel like given what's happening in Eastern Europe today in this autocratic ruler who's using history and abusing history and misusing it to like partly excuse what he's doing and to launch a real war, not like a war of words, but a war of, you know, death. And it's partly happening because we have this huge gap in true stories that were hidden. I just went really deep. I don't know how we got here, but
It's fine to
we
go
went
deep
from vodkas to this.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and they say this in the economy world too, is that there's amnesia about every 80 years or so, and it's just like, and that's when we need to, and I think that's why novels are one of the reasons why novels are so important, because if you read novels from those, right, I don't know about the like writers from Ukraine or that era. If there was novels that they wrote and got out at the time or what was happening. But when I read, say, novels about World War II and it's, you know, set in Italy or in Spain, and I feel like those are the things that are telling me what's going on. Because you could feel the emotional, not even the emotional turmoil, but the just emotional, like, how do I even cope when there's war at my doorstep? And there's almost, I mean, it's almost like when you know, I've never had anything amputated, but like when you amputate a limb, you still feel like you have a limb. It's like a phantom limb, and it's, and you don't feel the actual pain right away. So it's just, being in, I don't even know what the experience of being in a war is like, because I don't feel. Everyone feels like they'll be like, oh, if I was there, I'd be a savior and I'd get out there and blah, blah. And it's just like, you have no clue because you've never been in the situation. You don't know what is happening. We know what happened in the Bosnia and all that in the 90s and what's happening in Ukraine now. And it's, I hope, like, you know, with your novel and grabbing what you got to grab from your grandmother. And that's what gets us into the heart of these things.
Yeah, that was actually my biggest fear about writing this novel. I didn't write, I had kind of the story behind it because it's based on a real event. Like my grandfather passed away, and then my family found a letter he'd written earlier on that he'd sort of hidden away that was addressed to the KGB, and that revealed his lifelong secret about what really happened to him during the war. And once that happened, I immediately recognized it as a potential like seed for a novel. Mm-hmm. But I didn't touch it for 10 years. And one of the main reasons, I was sort of not in the right place, maybe partly, but the second reason was, I was like, who am I to write a story about a soldier in World War II? Like, I'm just a girl living in America, you know, and it's World War II. My God, like, is there anything more sort of heavier and presumptuous than to touch that? You know, it's like probably the most overwritten event in many ways. And to write it from a soldier's point of view, I've never been in a war, right? Like, I have no idea what it looks like. I mean, I can kind of figure that out from all the movies and, you know, research, but what it feels like, which is the most important part in really in doing fiction. And it really took, I would say, two events to sort of push me over, convince me that maybe I possibly could. One was, so the war in Ukraine that we have today actually started 10 years ago in 2014, in the city that my family lived in, and literally in front of my grandparents' apartment.
Wow.
And while I wasn't there myself, I would be on Skype with them throughout it. And then when it was kind of like safer, I visited the city. This is in the Donbas, which is a word people probably heard by now. Now it's the eastern, basically like the Rust Belt, kind of eastern part of Ukraine. Me and my brother crossed over from the Russian side and spent a couple of days there. And this, I was so shocked by what I saw, because it was completely a different place than it's been like all my life. and it was half dead. Like there was no one under the age of 50 at all anymore on the streets. They all left, my cousins is included. Like the buildings were mostly empty and dark. There was martial law, so you had to be back home by, I think, either 9 p.m. or 10 p.m., I forget. And me and my brother decided that we want to find, to see if there's any bars left in the city. This is a city of 1 million people, by the way. Like, this is not a small town, right? It's a big city. And we found a couple of underground bars. And then we had to rush back home because of martial law. And we're walking down kind of the center, like imagine like a big center street. There's big plazas and like a church. And, you know, normally there'd be traffic and lots of cars. And there's nothing, there's no cars, there's no humans. It's just me and my brother like hurrying, and we have 10 minutes left to get home. And all of a sudden we hear shelling, but I've heard shelling like in films. I've never heard it in real life. And so my mind wasn't ready for it or knew what it was. It took a few moments. And I was so scared. I clutched my brother's arm and he turned to me. He's like, well, that probably wasn't a pipe that fell, huh? And we kind of just, you know, we hurried on. But there's something about that experience, even though it was so minor, right? Like I wasn't on a battlefield or next to artillery or cannons. But there was just like something about that fear that made me see how I could take that small event and kind of expand it and build on it and create a reality that could be like fathomable for a soldier. And then the second event, kind of after that, I moved to Berlin with my husband. And Berlin, as you know, features prominently in World War II because that's where Hitler hung out. And that's kind of, it was like the place from which this war began in a way. And it plays an important role in kind of the Soviet imagination. People always like associated it, you know, with evil and the Nazis and whatever. And all of a sudden I moved to this place that I've heard so much about, that I grew up on Soviet films watching it. And it's a real place. And I see both, I both see remnants. Of war and not, and most once, as soon as I landed there, I kind of like this book started pouring out of me. But I think having seen war and having knowing that war can come to you unexpectedly and what that is like, that really helped, like actually, you know, be like, yeah, maybe I could write a World War II book from a perspective of a soldier. Let's try.
Yeah. It's interesting that you and your brother took the comedy when you heard the shell.
Well, that's, you know, Jewish blood for you, I suppose.
Yeah. Not that this is war, but it reminds me of when I lived in the Mission District, kind of in the gang area in San Francisco. You're in San Francisco. Yeah. And, you know, for like 20 years ago, there was, I don't know how it is now, but it was shots fired. You'd hear the shots at night, and then sometimes it'd be drive-bys, and I'd wait for the sirens to come out to see how many kills there were, and see, you know, tons of gang members all handcuffed, and there's just a point where you've lived there for so long, you're just like, I think that was that a shotgun, or do you think that was a pistol? That sounded a little more like a 22 instead of a 30, and it's almost like, it's just so strange to like be that close to gunfire and go, oh, we could have been outside walking. And at the same time, in order to process it, it's almost like you have to step outside yourself and kind of find, what are we going to do? Are we going to just crawl down and like weep and cry? Or are we going to just kind of make a little fun of it because we're just trying to get through life? I just want to walk to the bus tomorrow and be safe, you know?
Yeah. You know, that thing that you were saying about how you begin to distinguish which gun it is. That's what been happening with my family in Ukraine, is that they were, you know, not experts on anything. And now, and then through the years of living with shelling basically daily and nightly, They can tell you, you know, just by the sound. They can tell you how far it is, how like which side it's coming from, all the things. And it's a that's not a skill I ever want to have, frankly, you know.
No. When they're in that situation, I mean, I think I know the answer to this, but I want to put the answer to you. Why would they stay living there? What keeps a person living in that area?
Tony, this is such it's a great question. So for my family in particular, it began with the fact that my grandmother, who was 90 when the war began, or in her city, was not going to leave. And if you finish the book, I have a little bit of a scene in there about that, which is based on reality, because I would call my grandma and be like, "Grandma, can you please leave? Like, there's a war happening. Like, why are you still there? And you live in the center of town." And she would be like, "No, let him come and get me. I don't care. Like, I've survived crazier shit than this." You know, she lived through like the famine, Nazi occupation of Ukraine for 2 years.
Yeah.
Just like all kinds of madness. And now she was 90 and she's like, "No, this is my home. Like, I'm not gonna append my life." And my aunt and my uncle stayed sort of because of her initially. Then when she passed away a few years later, I sort of expected that they would leave, but they didn't. And then they stayed and stayed. And, you know, it became a little, they partly got used to it and became slightly less urgent. Like, it wasn't as bad as at the beginning, I suppose. But still, like, I just couldn't understand it. But also, I am an immigrant, right? I moved, and I moved even before I moved. Like, I moved even when I lived back in, I was born in Ukraine, then we moved to Russia, then we moved to another apartment, then we moved to a third apartment, then we moved here. You know, like, I've lived in I don't even know how many places. And so moving to me, and to, I think, people my age in general, and to Americans, certainly, it's easy. Like, it's not a difficult thing. You don't get as attached to home. But there, and for that generation, my aunt is now in her 70s, it's a whole different ballgame. Like, they've never been outside of the USSR. So if like of the former, you know, all the republics, they've traveled within it, mm-hmm. you know, it's a big piece of land. So they actually traveled to Central Asia and stuff, but that was it. They've never gone. And they had their home and they just like grew really attached to it. They also didn't want to depend. Like, once you move, you have to rent an apartment somewhere, and for that you need money. And if you live in a place that has a war zone, that means you can't sell your property and use that money to do something with, right? Like, we have three apartments sitting there empty. They're not gonna sell. There's a war going on, right? No one's buying anything. So that means you come out with like your savings, which are minuscule in Ukraine. And she just, yeah, they just didn't want to depend on the younger generation. Anyway, sorry, that was a long answer. But actually what it took for my aunt to finally leave, she left last year because she got cancer. And that's what did it. Because there's basically like no water in the hospitals. It's that bad. Mm-hmm. So her only, and no medicine, certainly. And so the only choice was for her to leave. So now she's in Kyiv. And I'm glad she's not in Eastern Ukraine, which has been taken over basically by Russia. And I don't think she would have enjoyed living under Putin at this point.
I don't think we understand people of that age and people of that generation. And it's, so we're not in their heads. So it's easy for us to say, just get out of there. But the concept, especially if they've been there through World War II, through other, it's just like, no, this is home. This is where I stand. You know, I can't put myself in the mind of a person like that, because I'm not that old yet, but I can understand that their angle on it is going to be different than mine. And, you know, who am I to know what's right?
Yeah. Also culturally, like, Americans move a lot more than people over there. I can't quite tell, but Western Europe, but in Eastern Europe, you typically don't go to another city for university, for example.
Mm.
You just go because the cities are on average, bigger than the US. And so there's usually like a decent enough university, unless you're super, super, you know, have big aspirations. Like my parents moved to Moscow to attend university. They moved from Ukraine and Uzbekistan, but that's very atypical. You typically just like live your life and wherever you were born, you know.
And so when you moved to a new place, like when were you with your parents when they moved to Moscow?
Yes.
Is it kind of not embraced yet? Is there kind of like a standoffish to new people coming into those areas? Because
Sorry, I misspoke. So my parents met obviously before I was born, because otherwise I'd be weird the other way. But
no, it could happen. It could be in vitro fertilization, and then sure. They could have like found this is the this. I'm gonna pitch a rom com to you. They find each other when you're nine.
There you go.
No, I'm kidding.
So they met as students, and my dad came from Ukraine. My mom came from Uzbekistan, both of which used to be part of the USSR, and they met as students. And then we like moved to Ukraine where I was born. And then when I was six, they moved back to Moscow. So I don't quite know the answer because I wasn't there in like the 70s or whatever when they were students, but I feel like I guess in my like class in Moscow, I was the only one not from there, but it wasn't something that I don't know. It wasn't something that was ever discussed, or it like made
and
me
you're
feel
six.
Like I was
You're
slightly
six.
different, but I don't think anyone else, right, like cared, you know?
Yeah. It's and when we're six, we think we're the weird ones all, you know, it's just like, oh, dear Lord, we're the weird one. You know, I used to pee my pants when I was six because I didn't know I could ask the teacher to go to the bathroom. So I would just,
there you go. Yeah.
It's just like, you know, and I can't wait until I get to that point in life when I don't know that I can ask the nurse to go to the bathroom, you know. Right. In the future, it all kind of comes together. You know how like a novel begins and ends and it kind of bookends. I'm gonna book mine end. Mine
Peeing.
is peeing my pants and then peeing my pants again. That'll be the
I think you're basically like every other human on earth. Yeah.
How long did you spend in Berlin? So and when you were in Berlin, that's when you really started kicking on the book. Yeah.
Yes. I was 7 months pregnant. And it was a funny situation because we didn't, me and my husband have like no relation to Germany. We didn't really know. We had like one friend there. But we were living in Warsaw before that. And then once I got pregnant, we decided we want to move somewhere else. And then we're just kind of eeny, meeny, miny, moe through European capitals, and Berlin made the most sense. Anyway, so we moved there at 7 months. And I was obviously like, my main plan was to just give birth. I wasn't expecting to be writing a novel, but it just kind of happened. I think the environment around me made me do it. Plus, there's something about the deadline. I really like, I'm a journalist, and so I love deadlines. And there's something about having a baby in 2 months that's like the ultimate deadline, because you feel like that's it, my life will end. And I always wanted to be a writer, but I like a fiction writer, novelist, but I wasn't yet. And I felt like if I'm going to give birth and I still won't even make, you know, attempt to do the thing that I've always wanted to do, I will kind of never do it, you know, this is my last chance or something. Anyway, so I started writing it at 7 months, and then continued afterward, which was nice. It gave me, you know, it gave me like, I was somebody all of a sudden. I wasn't just like a mom to a baby, which could happen, right? And some people are super into it, but I don't know. I was very nervous that I wanted some other identity in my life. And so this novel became kind of my identity. I almost stopped in the pandemic. I was just kind of loose, you know, pandemic was tough in different ways. And it had been by that point, like 3 years or so. And I was pregnant with a second kid, and I was worried about money, and nobody's paying me to write this novel. What am I doing, right? And then my husband, bless his soul, was like, "You are going to finish this novel, Sasha." And I was like, "Okay, fine, I'll finish."
Oh, that's great!
Yeah, he was super, super encouraging.
Yeah. No, I get all those feelings except for the pregnancy part. I don't understand that quite as well. But yeah, I when you said this 7 months in the deadline, I was like, wow, did you get a first draft done in 2 months? And then when you were in labor, you're like, stay in, we got another 100 pages, stay in.
No, yeah, that'd be epic if I did. No, I'm kind of slow. Plus, like, this was my first. I'm sort of hoping that I won't be so slow next time. But I was slow. I had no idea what I'm doing. It's a pretty complex structure, right? Because it alternates between World War II and 70 years of history from World War II until 2015. And so it involved a lot of research, and I would like get bogged down in that a lot. It was research that was hard to find kind of research. It took me a long time. I emailed this historian because one of the central questions without which I really couldn't have written this novel was, how does a Jewish prisoner of war survive in Nazi Germany? Like, what would they need to do to hide the fact that they're Jewish, right? Because like all you kind of typically read about World War II is about the Jewish side of things is like the camps and right, the Holocaust, where it doesn't feel like there's any easy way to escape once the Nazis have you. And so the question is, okay, what if you're a prisoner of war, right? So you're a soldier, but you also happen to be Jewish, like what, how will you then survive? And I emailed this very, very famous historian who's written many books about World War II and Eastern Europe. And his answer was, I have no idea. So that didn't help. And then I was a little discouraged. And it took me a while to find the answer to that question because it really can only come from firsthand accounts. And my grandpa was dead, so I couldn't ask him how he was able to survive as a captured soldier in Nazi Germany for 4 years. And so the answer had to come from somewhere else. Anyway, eventually I found two like Jewish, Soviet Jewish historians who looked into this, thank God. Because I couldn't have written the book at all without it. Anyway, research, bogging down to research takes time. I'm not very organized either. I don't know if you are, but
No, I'm terribly. This is how I've been. I thought I would, the novel I'm currently working on, I thought it would take a year. I'm on 2.5 years right now. And I just realized like a month and a half ago that I have to completely changed the protagonist from 40 years old to 17 years old. And it's been right in my face this whole time, which really sucks because now the whole new novel is a new thing, but it's not at the same time. It's almost worse than starting another novel. So
yeah.
I'm my I write on like a handwrite and then I type into the computer and then I just have a Word document. And that's all I've been doing. So I'm about to invest in getting Scrivener and just start playing with it because as I'm play, because there's scenes that need to be in, and there's scenes that need to be totally rewritten, and there's new scenes, and I'm like writing them on index cards, and I'm like, okay, my brain's done trying to keep this organized. So I'm very unorganized as a writer, but maybe after today, this might be the new me. I don't know. How are you on? Do you use like a software, or are you
I looked into Scrivener when I was working on a different project before the novel, and I was like, one day, if I ever write a novel, I'm gonna use Scrivener. And then I never did. It was like too, yeah. So no, I
too
just
much,
it
huh?
yeah. And it probably would have been useful, like if you get over the entry hurdle. No, it yeah, I Word it's Word doc. I do have my like each chapter is its own document. I find that that's easier because then I can swap them out.
And that
But
makes, you
it.
know what? You may have just talked me out of even trying a Scrivener. I might just do that because that may let my brain be easy because I don't need to sit here and work on trying to figure out a new software when I could probably do the finish this rewrite in 3 months in my normal way of lunacy. But it's like everything's there, it's just got to come from a different, younger perspective. So.
That sounds like fun. 17 is that's a fun age to work with.
Well, and it was right in front of me the whole time. This guy, this middle-aged man has like mom and dad issues and all this stuff. I'm just like, what was I thinking? Throw him younger, and throw him in the mess, same as that, and it works like even better. So I was writing the sequel, and as I was writing the sequel, I was like, well, let's go back in time, and because that's kind of really interesting to me. And as I was writing him at 17 is when I went, oh, ah, the whole, I blew it. Okay. So anyway, yeah, I don't know. My answer to I hope the next one's easier. I do. But actually, I'm really hoping the next one's just the sequel to, that one goes through quick, and then they start calling me James Patterson, and I'm at all the airports in the world.
And you have those assistants painting your nails.
Oh, assistants
And you're
painting my nails.
dictating.
Dictating. Comma, semicolon, semicolon, dash, dash. Use the M dash, not quotes. Who do you think you are? These are the fantasies that writers have.
Yep, definitely.
And then how did you land in San Francisco? What brought you to the beautiful city by the bay?
My mom, who is a psychologist, I think she went when we still lived in Moscow. She went on some sort of psychologist thing, conference. I don't know what it was. And they spent some time here or in Big Sur. And it must have been great weather because she came back and was like, oh, it's the place of eternal spring. And so that's kind of how she pitched it. But that we they actually she won a green card lottery
Oh.
and we immigrated at the beginning of 1996 in the middle of very snowy January in Moscow and landed here. I've been in San Francisco ever since. I was in the middle of 7th grade, so I had to go, start like the second semester of 7th grade in a public high school, public middle school in San Francisco, an ESL class. And I
Right.
can tell you a
How
thousand stories about that, but
was how much English did you know before getting
so
here?
I learned, how you learn a foreign language at school, right? You probably took like a Spanish or French or something.
Yeah, and
So
I'm taking Spanish lessons now and realizing that some of it stayed, but most of it didn't. So.
So I had English as a class at school from like 1st grade onward. It was British, like pronunciation wise, it was British, so that was part of it. But I was a really good student and I was like good at my English class, but other than that, it wasn't I wasn't amazing at it. But once I got to public middle school in San Francisco. And I kind of honestly feel like public middle school in America is hell on earth, frankly. Like, I just don't think there's anything worse than that for children to go through. It's very different than in Europe and Russia and
Yeah.
Ukraine. Like, there must be a reason why Americans decided to separate elementary, middle, and high school. And I think it's mostly to just like take those preteens and separate them out from the rest of society,
Yeah,
somehow
yeah.
just like anyway, but
Make them good workers. It's all about getting good employees. That's all we need, right? It's
oh well, yeah, sure. Capitalist, good capitalist society.
Right.
Anyway, my goal in life became to get out of ESL class. But what's funny, I think there's probably, I mean, I assume it's changed. I honestly don't know. But I just assumed because it can't stay the same. There was no way to get out of ESL class. Once you're in ESL class, you're in ESL class basically for life. There's no
Oh, wow.
test.
Yeah.
There was like no procedure at all.
Huh.
And once I realized, I kept waiting. I was like, oh, okay, the semester will end and they'll test me out of it. Then I'll like move on with my life. And then once the test, it didn't happen, I kind of marched to the vice principal's office. And I was like, listen, there seems to be no way to get out of ESL class. And I want to get out of ESL class. So get me out of ESL class. And she was just so kind of so shocked by the fact that somebody just barged in her and was making demands that she was like, okay. sure, we'll get you out of ESL class. And I was like, and also see that guy, Alex, get him out too. He doesn't need to be in ESL class. So I got me and this other Russian kid out of ESL class, which allowed me to get into full high school in a year from then.
Fun.
Yeah.
You know. So what languages do you speak? You speak Ukrainian?
I don't speak Ukrainian, which is interesting, particularly today, given the war. But so I grew up speaking Russian. And then because I left Ukraine before school started, I never got like Ukrainian classes. So my older brother does speak it a little bit because he took it for 4 years, but I never did. And then my grandparents, who are kind of the basis behind the main characters of Yefim and Nina, they were born speaking Ukrainian. It's their native language. But I swear to you, I did not know this until even kind of until I was researching this book. It just I in the 90s, I realized that they spoke it because all of a sudden TV in Ukraine, when I'd visit them in Ukraine, it used to be in Russian. Then one summer I came back to visit them and it was suddenly all in Ukrainian and I couldn't really understand it, but they could. And the newspapers were in Ukrainian, some of them. So I was like, oh, I guess they speak of this other language that I totally don't speak, which is Ukrainian in the country of Ukraine. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But it was only when I was researching this book that it dawned on me that their native language was not Russian. Like that's not the language they spoke when they were born. And it's kind of such a shock but it also reflects what like Soviet Union's project was. It was really to delete all of these languages and turn everybody into Russian speakers, right? Because if you take over a bunch of countries and they all have very different cultures, like let's say, I don't know, Lithuania up north and Kazakhstan or something, or Uzbekistan, right? Like these people have never met. They don't share a lot in common, but you're going to rule them together. And so the main thing in the authoritarian like textbook is you give them a language, you give them the same language, right? And that's going to give them kind of similar identity. So my grandparents' generation, like all of those people spoke their own different languages. And then by the time they had kids, they typically spoke either both, but usually Russian dominated with some exceptions. By the time it was my generation, that other language was dead. And, you know, so, and then there's been a resurgence of these languages in Ukraine, obviously in Belarus, and all the Stan countries in Central Asia. But yeah, but it was such a project. And I think it's only working on this book that I realized and seeing the war in Ukraine that has a lot to do with language, that it's dawning on me, like what a loss that was, and what, you know, what like a terrible project it was to kill all those languages off.
And how would they kill those languages off? Is it just like you no longer can speak to each other this way in public? Is it get that crazy? Or is it just like now all your media is going to be delivered to you in Russian? So catch up. And that just kind of
all
permeates.
The media, all schools, all jobs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's pervasive. It's everywhere. All signs, you know, documents. And like, yeah, unless you speak it, you're not going to advance in any way. And but it really starts with children, is that they are instructed in Russian and all of a sudden their kind of family's native language either isn't taught at all or is taught as like a foreign language. It's usually very boring. No one is into it. Like I'm judging by how it went kind of for my aunt and uncle, my cousins, you know, they like spoke it, but it was, they'd roll their eyes at this like Ukrainian class they had to take.
Wow.
That's
for the
that's
old
not how
people.
they feel
We
about
want
it
the
now.
punk rock Russian, man. Come on, let's go.
Yeah. You also like, right. You kill off or just kind of get rid of literature. So like any writers writing in that language, you don't publish them or you send them to the gulag or whatever. Right?
Wow.
So there's many creative ways, Tony, to kill a language. But it's remarkable how quickly it changes, you know?
Did you know? I read that you also lived in Bologna.
Yes, I live in Bologna and I speak Italian. I guess you initially asked me if I speak Ukrainian, so I speak Russian, Ukraine, Russian, Italian, and English a little bit. Haha. And just a little, a smattering of like, a bit of French here, Polish there, kind of thing. But
And
that's it.
how did you survive in Germany? If you did did you speak more
That's
English
an
there?
interesting story. No, I learned no German in Germany.
Hmm.
And I actually was working on an essay about that because I learn normally languages pretty easily, and I like them. But when I was in Germany, I just couldn't do it. There was something about German, and I was right, like we discussed, I was 7 months pregnant, then I had this baby, I had other things to do, I was working on a novel. But I had some sort of very strong internal resistance to learning German. It was also like you don't really need it in Berlin, honestly. Like all the waitresses are Australian, basically, and they don't even speak German either.
They don't even speak. They don't have the same English we do. It's the, good day, I.
Right,
And you're
yeah.
like, what?
But my mom kept being like, "Why aren't you learning German?" And she's at some point she sent me like Pimsleur, that language software. She copied like Pimsleur German from the library or something and sent me these CDs, and I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. And I think it's partly, I think it's not partly, but mainly some sort of mix of like, I don't know if it's generational trauma fully, but maybe just more the way I was brought up on this like Germans are the enemy from World War II thing.
I had that from
And
my
my only
Norwegian
ex
grandpa too. It's just like he would never talk. He would never talk about exactly what happened in Nazi occupied Norway, but it was all Germans were bad, and it's just that was his. And even when I went to Europe for the first time in the 90s, and I was like, oh, maybe I'll go to Stavanger, and he's like, you don't want to go visit your relatives. They're all the only ones your age are Nazis. And I'm just like, okay. And I didn't really care that much about Norway anyway. I wanted to go to France. I was like, I want to go sit at my heroes' graves in Père Lachaise and be near the, dead writers. That was my big plan. So, but yeah, I guess, and the generational traumas, I really feel that too. I feel that we don't get what do you call it? It just even from the pain that my grandparents had for so I feel like for some odd reason it is sent down, even if we don't know exactly why or what, but we know that there were huge problems. And no one really told me the whole story, so. But at the same time, it's just like maybe some of what I go through, where I get over catastrophic, is maybe because of Grandpa Tor coming down and going knocking on my head. Who knows? Anyway, oh, go ahead.
No, I both feel bad that I didn't learn it, but also we only stayed there a year, and so I was kind of we were kind of like non-committal anyway with Germany, and we had just spent a year in Warsaw, and we had to like learn some Polish, and then we realized we're not going to stay there, and I was like, well, we can't move every year and learn a new language. That's just too much. But there was also just a weird general like resistance to it.
I want to go to Krakow. Like this is I got a plan for this year, and then for next year, I got like Krakow on my list and Berlin, and but Bologna. I'm very interested in Bologna. That's why I brought it up. What was it? How long were you there?
I was there a year, but tell me why you're interested in Bologna, because all of a sudden Bologna is like seems to be the hot thing this month. I don't know
Oh, is
why.
it? Forget it, then I'm out. No, I'm looking for the not hot thing. I'm in the middle of setting up my dual citizenship to Italy through Ancestry, and at the same time, I'm like, hey, I don't know if I live in Italy a year or two from now, and I'm just there. So I was talking. Oh, I went on a this is months ago. I went on an online date with a woman who's actually her family is from the exact same region in Calabria as my family who came over to. So I told her the last names of my great grandparents, and she's like, "Oh my God! Like I know your whole family because It's like just all our cousins. We're probably related. It's like crazy. But yeah. And then, but I don't, you know, I don't know if, yeah, I'm doing location scouting, you know, and when, so I'm can't wait to go to Italy, and Bologna is kind of high on my list. I've already been to like Florence and the Cinque Terre and stuff. And I don't want to be in a tourist area. I kind of just want to be like settled into just a town, a city. And Bologna, just as I research it, I haven't been there yet, but it's just like, I kind of like the vibe, and that it's a college town, and it's not a destination. It's not the itinerary on a, when you have 15 days in Italy, go straight to Bologna. You know, it's like, yeah, I want it off.
Becoming that, just I'm judging by the fact that you're the fourth person to mention Bologna in the span of a month to me.
Really?
To me, and I don't know that many, you know.
Now the other three people, were they cool, or were they kind of like, am I going, is it going to be like an expat population that would be cool, or are these guys like, you know, tourists?
Well, they were visiting, so none of them were living there, mind you. But I was I was there like as a student in 2003, so a long time ago.
And you probably Italiano.
I'm also, my husband went through the same process of getting Italian citizenship. So
did
I can tell you a lot more about it if you need some help. I have a company that helps out with that. And
yes,
a really great visit.
Yeah, no, I'm yes, because I'm in the middle of kind of a stopgap right now that the whole world doesn't need to know. But yeah, I'll ask you about that. But
why I'm doubly excited to go to Italy on book tour in September, because I'm now I speak it. I started actually. I kind of fell into Italian by mistake, basically, at Lowell High School in San Francisco. I was supposed to take Spanish, and then I got put into Italian class, and then I was going to switch. I'm like, you know what? I actually really like this Italian thing. I think I'm going to stick to it. And then now I'm married to somebody who's like, it just kind of became my life in many ways, but very coincident, like incidentally. Italy, the Italian publisher, which is Garzanti, is a great publisher. I'm super excited to work with them. I met with my publisher in Milan last summer, and I just felt like she so understood my book on this like whole other level. So I'm really excited. I'm going to be at the Pordenone Book Festival.
Fun.
Which would be cool. Yeah.
I just read this author. I think her name is Victoria Raimi. Well, it'd be Italiano. It'd be Raimi or Raimo or something. And her book was called Lost on Me. And I like finished the last page today. And I've read like maybe four or five Italian novelists in the last year. And there's just something about contemporary Italian writers right now coming out that are just like grabbing my heart, where it's just, I'm just like, oh my God. It feels different. Why does it feel different than what we're getting in the United States? Just a little bit. And I can't put my finger on it, but it's, I don't know if you know that author.
I do. She came to Litquake, I think, like two
years
ago.
Oh, no way.
Ago.
Oh, yeah. Damn it. I didn't get up there for it. Oh,
that's
got
how
it.
I found out about her.
Lost on Me is fantastic. I'm gonna read it again and annotate it. I'm so crazy about it.
Oh, cool. Yeah. She was great. She was like so smart. It was like one of the smart, I mean, authors are generally not dumb, I guess, but when you hear them at events, sometimes, I don't know. She was just super profound. And I was like, oh yes, you're European. I can tell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Veronica Raimo.
See, you say it so much better than me. I'm like, Veronica Raimo.
I think you were thinking Vittoria or something, but yeah, it's Veronica. Yeah, Veronica. She's super smart. She's a translator as well. So yeah, she's.
Yeah, all this stuff. I love this world of novelists and writers, because I'm just always excited. It's just, sometimes I'm depressed, but you know, that's when I get to page 50 and I'm like, nah, I'm done. I am done with this relationship with this author. We are done. And they don't even know it. They're just like, well, at least you bought the book.
I'm wondering, I'm looking forward to seeing what people, you know, how people take this book, because like none of it happens in America, and most contemporary fiction in the US is very much like about the US, which makes sense, right? And this one is very much not. It's a different, it's mostly in a different time. It's all in a different land. And yeah, I'll be curious to see how it lands with American readers. So far, like from early readers, it's been really great to hear from like other Soviet-born people, because this book means like a lot more to them than just a novel.
Yeah.
Right. Because they, I've already heard, like even the designer who designed the cover, she works for Bloomsbury, for my publisher. So she was just one of their designers on staff, but she happens to also be an immigrant from Moscow. And she also happens to have a grandfather who had a very similar story. And she apparently just cried reading this book. Aww. And she's like talked about it as well. And she was like very afraid to read it and then read it and was like, oh my God, I can't wait to design the cover. This is like, so right. When you write something that's a novel, that's great. But when you write something that's a novel, but also like really touches people, or I had another person who told me that she started asking her family questions after reading my book and learned all these crazy things about her family that she had no idea about. Like, right? That's a whole different effect. That, you know, that like I didn't even aspire to have, but I'm seeing it happen. So I hope to hear more stories like that, and that people, you know, like find not necessarily buried secrets of their family, but just figure out things about the past and kind of look at the past in a different, possibly more nuanced way than we've been taught.
Yes. I love the word nuance. Nuance is everything.
It really is. Yeah. And I think in like right in today's like misinformation age, that's really what it needs. Like everyone is so polarized all the time. And no, like the more, you know, the more we play into the polarization, the worse things are going to get. Like they're not going to have, and nuance is like, things are more complex than that, guys. You know?
Yeah. And most people are really good. It's just that people have inherent good in them, I think. It's, I hope. It's, who knows? You're looking at me like, Tony,
let's hope so. I love
you. It's an American way to think.
I love you, American.
you just go straight to speaking in Russian going, yet. Sasha, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Tony. It's been a great, great fun to talk to you.
You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCRLP, 92.9 FM, Los Gatos and beyond.